The time is August 1997 when the Event Horizon, a cutting-edge experimental spaceship designed to travel faster than light, mysteriously disappears on its maiden voyage. The ship suddenly appears 7 years later, and a rescue mission is launched harboring the creator of the ship and an experienced crew to investigate what happened. What the crew discovers on board is beyond anything they could have ever imagined. As they approach the lost ship orbiting Neptune, the crew realizes that the Event Horizon's fateful journey has opened a door to the hellish alternate dimension, where pure evil is waiting for them. With the boundaries between reality and nightmare dissolving, the crew is pushed to the brink of madness as they comfort the horrifying truth. The ship has become a gateway to the world of unspeakable terror. Time and space are no longer their allies, and every step deeper into the ship pulls them further into salvation and deeper into hell. In a race against time and sanity, they must unravel the mystery of the Event Horizon's fate before they become the next victim of its hell-raising past. This week on Back to the Balcony, we cover the 1997's cult film, Event Horizon.
Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert, two titans of cinematic review. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong, but always captivating. Your hosts Antonio of the Cult Worthy Cinema Podcast and Justin Henson of the Movie Wire are here to take you back to the balcony.
Okay, so first and foremost, kicking off the summer, I had to put on my Hawaiian Jaws shirt to kind of get us going. So this one was released in August over the summer, and it just didn't feel right to not dress for the occasion. But this one is going to be an interesting conversation because we've never talked about this film. And this is one to me that has been a favorite from the start, mainly for the wrong reasons. It's gory, yes. Does it tap into seclusion? Yes. Does it follow the same tropes from horror movies past? Yes. But at the same time, we have seen this before. But it's so hypnotic in its delivery that it makes director Paul W.S. Anderson, he knows how to bring the visual fun and keep the tone of engagement based on the material. This is a director that keeps the material at face value, right? And keeps the tone consistent. This is one of those movies that I have a short list of movies I fall asleep to. And this is on those, as morbid as it sounds, I know. But it's between the delivery of the dialogue, the hypnotic sound editing, that really does keep this, and yes, I do wake up in the midst of screams, but this is one that really does get me to just kind of take me in a hypnotic trance with its execution. So I'm curious, because again, we haven't talked about this one. Let's go, Antonio. Fingers crossed.
Oh, I mean, come on, we're of the same generation. This is an absolute favorite of mine. And yeah, I think you took the words right out of my mouth for all the wrong reasons, you know? There's something to be said about the 1990s, especially like 95 to 2000, before we really got heavy in the paint of Matrix-style sci-fi action. You know, so you have this the same year that Alien Resurrection comes out. And they're both very similar in the sense of visual style. They're still heavily reliant on practical special effects. They're still heavily reliant on good old-fashioned gore and squibs, but with enough of that 90s CGI to see that the future is coming, it's just not polished yet. And I think one of the things that I like the most about this movie, and I liked back then, I don't want to give away the critics' review quite yet because they weren't favorable of it, but what they do bring up is the comparisons to films that are like it, right? Something's on the spaceship. Very recognizable, old-fashioned sci-fi trope. Alien's not the first one, right? They bring up Solaris. 100% this is a Solaris ripoff. But I'm going to get to my point in a second. The idea of being in space, away from civilization, into the unknown, that we can blend the thought of, let's say, biomechanic horror like in Alien, but also supernatural horror like in Solaris. I love that. I don't care what the package is. I just love the idea that someone took those two films that I love so much and put their own spin on it, this kind of satanic, in a sense, because we are led to assume that they go through hell and bring back hell with it, right? But also the paranoia and inner workings of people's own paranoias working against them. I like it. This is Paul W.S. Anderson's best film, in my opinion. I say his second best film is probably one of his least favorite, and that's Soldier from just a couple years later with Kurt Russell. Like, I love both of these movies. So that being said, do I agree with people's opinions of this movie that it's not great? Of course I do, but I don't care what they think because it's great to me. I love the industrial music that doesn't really match the tone, but it works for some reason. You know, it's not this harmonic, creepy music. It's hardcore, industrial, almost borderline electronica music. I love the performances of the actors. Yeah, the script is wobbly, but when you have great effects and great performances, it doesn't matter. So I'm going to put this in the bookmarks of 90s sci-fi horror classics that just work for me and work for lots of people because it's a cult favorite, and I can put all of the critics' opinions aside.
And would I say I like it for the wrong reasons? And you mentioned it when it comes to the music not matching the tone. This is a movie of contradiction. This is a movie that really goes against the performances versus the dialogue, the music versus what we're seeing on screen. And I think that's what makes this movie stand out as interesting, especially when we take Sam Neill's character, who just 3 years prior, 4 years prior, got off of Jurassic Park, who really, we had an expectation for this actor on what we're going to get. And he doesn't change his acting style. He has that brilliance to him, but that curiosity, that ignorance to him, that really does fulfill what this character is interesting, what he's all about. So to me, I think, especially when it comes to the music, this tug and pull of tone really does move this story forward. And there is a scene that I caught the last viewing that I didn't catch before, that we have the scene where they're opening this chamber, and instead of all this technology that could have been pumped into this movie, it's like a cast iron trigger to open this door. And it's something so simple and so small in detail that it opens up a more appreciation for this movie, that we have this vast piece of technology. We have the possibilities that this was intended to be a summer blockbuster.
Well, so let's talk about that, the visuals and the production design. One of the things I love about this movie is that, yes, when you're like in the cockpit in certain areas of the ship, it seems very futuristic, like it should, that it is keeping up with the technology. This is supposed to be 2040 something. But I love the fact that it feels like a gothic horror, that, like you just said, the cast iron girders and gears that open doors, to me, you're very reminiscent of something from like an old gothic castle, right? Or some kind of vault that you're going to seal someone in Frankenstein's lab, right? There's a lot of gothic feel to this mixed in with the modern technology that it's trying to impose. I love that because it really makes you know that you're in a horror film. And I think that is the confusion that a lot of people have, is that, is this a horror film first and sci-fi later, or vice versa? I think it's a horror film. I think it's a ghost story that just happens to take place on a spaceship. Just like Alien is essentially a slasher with a supernatural, not supernatural, with a otherworldly entity instead of a madman with a knife. So again, like the recipe is the same. You're just changing the ingredients and making it work. And I think this is a time where people were not ready for such genre bending. Or maybe they were ready for it. They just hadn't been given the right movie yet, you know? And I think that in hindsight, 10 years after this came out, huge hit on video, huge hit on DVD, it is a cult classic because people went back and realized how ahead of a time it was. Going to the next part of, you know, my analysis of this film, because this film really is so special to me, it is the fact that we have two very strong performances from Lawrence Fishburne and from Sam Neill. Two actors that at this point in their career were mostly either cast as like father figures or gang leaders, mobsters, things like that. But here, Lawrence Fishburne gets to play an actual hero, which up to this point, he really didn't get. And then Sam Neill gets to play essentially the good guy who sees himself become the villain, which is something that he didn't really get to do that much either. He was always like the cuckolded husband, maybe a secret agent. If we go back to 1981's Possession, he kind of covers all three. He's like the nice husband, then he's a piece of shit, and then eventually there's a devil side to him as well. Like he gets to revisit that kind of intensity, and it's great because I think that people who discovered him in Jurassic Park only expected him to be Alan Grant. And to see him do something different and bring in this villainous and antagonistic attitude to a film, I found refreshing, but I know a lot of people didn't like it, and the critics even kind of talk about that. It's like, you know, that's the thing, is like when you have a presumption of what a character and what an actor is supposed to be because of their previous work, then you're not giving the actor his due credit of being a performer, of being able to adapt to a character. And I got to go back. Like, this is the 90s where people are known for that. Like, Anthony Hopkins, regardless what role he's in, is going to be Anthony Hopkins on different levels. And we just expected that of our movie stars back then. We didn't really think about the range as we used to. De Niro was always De Niro. Pacino was always Pacino. That's just where we were in that era. And I think now people are so fluid in their performances that a performance like this would be appreciated much better.
I think when it comes to the cast, when we take, this is a Lawrence Fishburne movie, because this one really does test his range a little bit for that authoritarian figure, that survivalist, if you will. But I'm going to contradict a lot of perception of the Sam Neill character, because Sam Neill is a fantastic actor because mm-hmm. he has on-screen likability. But from Dead Calm going forward, this is where he really never does test his range. He's a situational actor. We can place him in, and with his natural on-screen curiosity of a role, he really doesn't change anything. And even here, I hate to say it because I loved him in this, because if I say I love him in this, I'm going to love him in everything else he's done, because it's almost the same character, just a different persona. Even when we get to scientist to villain, it really doesn't test his range. They put some makeup on him. They give some blood on his skin. And then he just talks in a different octave. So this is one where Sam Neill has a talent that I'm going to compliment, that he can be anybody. He can play anybody. And with his just straightforward formula of performance, he can convince us of that. But he has to be in the right role. And this is why we see Sam Neill in so many just kind of oddball projects, because he knows what his range is. He knows what he can do. He's not looking to blow people out of the water, but he knows what he can do, and he wants to stay in his comfort zone. And I think this is where in the 90s, it really wasn't ready for it, because you have two different elements to it. You have the heroic Alan Grant from Jurassic Park that becomes an antagonist that people really hated. You have a horror sci-fi movie that tests the boundaries of horror and religion that people weren't ready for. This is where this movie would have really excelled now, because you really test the waters of horror. You have emotional horror. You have elevated horror. So the 90s wasn't an experimental time when it comes to how people viewed horror, and especially how we view these characters. This is a fantastic cast, and even though I love this movie, this was a wrong time for it, but it has aged extremely well.
Extremely well. Yeah, I think that if it was to come out now with modern day special effects, I mean, even with a different cast, I think that there's enough bones to it that the right filmmaker could do a lot with it. I mean, and it's hard to even like ignore the fact that, you know, even watching movies like Alien Romulus, right? Like, there are a lot of, I'm going to say, throwbacks to at least the visual style and aesthetics that were set in this movie. If Aliens set the precedent of grungy space, of dingy futuristic, you know, retro future, essentially, this kind of brought it into the next era, where it almost feels like a submarine, but in space, with all that cool blade work and the hallways and stuff like that. It's very visually stunning, and we've seen a lot borrowed from it. And, you know, here's the thing. Like, if you think about, like, let's say proof of concept, right? Everything borrows from each other. And the one thing that I definitely noticed when I was a kid watching this, or whatever, I was 16 when it came out, I don't think I'd seen Solaris yet. I knew what it was, but I hadn't seen it. I didn't know the details of it. When I first saw this film, I was like, oh, this is essentially Sphere in space. Sphere being my favorite Michael Crichton novel. You like the adaptation for film better than I do, but I'm, you know, I don't hate it. And I think that came out a year after this did. But then when I saw Solaris, I was like, oh, wait, Sphere is essentially Solaris underwater. And then this is essentially Solaris with horror themes to it and a lot of gore and violence. I don't hate that. I think that it's great that there are these authors, these writers, these filmmakers that pay homage to such great work that it is kind of like, Scooby Snacks for us to like, oh, that's a Solaris moment, or that's like a Sphere moment. I mean, the second they saw that big spherical shape that is the drive that takes this thing into hell, that may as well have been the Sphere from Sphere. I love those kind of homages and connections where some people would call it, you know, a complete ripoff. That's what's great about cinema is like, you can do anything you want and you can literally heavily borrow from another film's aesthetic or plot device. But if you make it your own, if you put a horror spin on it, if you just touch it enough, but be different enough, no one's really going to hold it against you unless they're haters, right?
100%. And I just want to go on the record that I did not like Sphere. It's a horrible adaptation. I loved the cast and performances. So I just want to clear
the air. I just remember you speaking
here
favorably about something with that movie. And I was like, really?
I loved the cast, not the adaptation. But here's the thing. You're absolutely right, because I was going to tackle the Sphere aspect too, because it is so easy to include a sphere in a horror movie, because that's the endless rotation of fear, and that's a symbolic nature of it. Crichton did it brilliantly in his novel, the adaptation, not so much. Here it's done, to me, a lot better, because there's a hellish stake to it that really does have a crescendo of climax of just bloody stakes that we get from this movie.
Well, it's Hellraiser too. Like, it's Hellraiser in space as well.
100%. And I think the problem that this movie may have, if I were to nitpick it, is I know this movie had a longer cut. It had bigger ideas that really took us into the depths of hell that was cut short, and I would have loved to see that cut. That is where I think it doesn't really lean in to the hellish piece of it, of the personas of hell or the paranoia of the cast members. It doesn't go far enough in that. But I think with the visuals, it does supplement it to an extent where we don't really need it. And I think that's where it does a really good job on kind of pivoting to what's cut out based on the visuals that we see on screen. So this is where, in comparison to Sphere, I think it does a much better job on creating that environment of seclusion, and that seclusion leading to hell.
I'm curious, like, what do you think it is where critically this film did not favor well with almost any critic when it came out? It was kind of a bomb. It really kind of made Paul W.S. Anderson become the genre director that he is today. I think if the film would have been a financial success, we would have seen him do better films in the future. But because this, and I believe his follow-up was Soldier, and then the first Resident Evil movie, that kind of locked him in to what he has looked at now, which is kind of like, you know, a sci-fi horror hack, which I think the dude does have some talent, but I also feel like he knows what people expect and he'd rather keep a career than mess with what his legacy would be. Because we've seen a lot of directors like that try and like take a step away from it and not do well, and then maybe never get a chance again. So I think he's really embraced who he is. He's like, I'm the Schlockmeister. That's what people think of him now, right? But I think if this movie would have performed better, I think that would have changed the perception of him as a filmmaker and maybe gotten him better projects. But going back to my question, what is it that you think critics did not like about this film in the 90s, but audiences found appealing later on? Marketed terribly, right? So people didn't really go see this in the theater, but they discovered it over time. What's the disconnect?
You nailed it right there. This movie based itself off of marketing the gore. It marketed, this is the one of the most shocking, gory movies you will see. And when you put that with Sam Neill, Lawrence Fishburne, people are like hesitant on if they want to pay a ticket to go see this movie in theaters.
Right.
So the 90s isn't really a gore fest at this point, maybe slasher to an extent, but not a sci-fi blood fest. So if this movie is a product of its own failure, where they thought they had a hook and it was the wrong direction, and this one wouldn't have been word of mouth because, like I said prior, this is a movie that tackled religion, sci-fi, gore, bloody violence, and a protagonist that people loved that turned into antagonist. This had a recipe for disaster in theaters. But when it came to video, this is where people wanted to see that gore from the comfort of their own home at a cheaper price that really did fall in love with this movie. And again, there's a lot of people that I know that saw this movie that didn't love it at first viewing, but grew to love it and appreciate it. But I think when it comes to the critical piece of it, this movie, I'm not going to deny, it does have moments that feel like it's something missing. There's something that needed to be added. It needed an additional 15, 20 minutes to explain a character arc. So there are missing elements, but that doesn't take away for what this movie's intent was and what it tried to do. But it failed because of wrong time, wrong place, and not ready for the performances that we got.
I think one of the things I find interesting is that this movie was rushed into production and into post-production. Essentially, from the opening, let's say the first day of filming to release, it was 10 months. So for a film like that, that is crazy fast. That usually should be like at least a year and a half or more. They rushed it because they wanted to beat Alien Resurrection to the theaters. This came out in the summer. That came out like right around like Thanksgiving, Christmas time is when Alien Resurrection came out. They wanted to beat it. It almost makes sense to me that if Alien came out first and this came out second, it might have done better because it would have whetted the appetite for people for sci-fi horror again because we hadn't had an Alien film in like 10 years, right? So that's where I think that kind of came into play, where I think the audiences just weren't ready for this to be that kind of a summer movie. If they would have been pushed back a little bit longer, had Alien come out first, I think we would have seen a different story with this. But that's just my hypothesis when you look at all the other films that came out around the same time as this one. And 97 was a big year, and it's an artsy year too. You know, you got Big Lebowski coming out. You had Jackie Brown coming out. This really just felt out of place for the time of 1997 that it came out in.
I think you're 100% right. I think this one, even though on the surface level, felt like a summer movie, but at the, my opinion, if this would have came out October, November, right before the holidays in the gloomy season, People are mentally set to see something depressive, gloomy, and scary and uncomfortable. So we have a natural reaction for those that go to the movies to kind of set our expectations of horror movie in October, gloomy movie in November, we're going to go see it. But seeing Sam Neill as an antagonist and seeing all the blood and gore in an August release, not so much. A full sci-fi movie, absolutely.
All right, so before we get into the critics' opinions of this film, yeah, I'll come out and say that I just really, really enjoy this movie. I always have. I understand where its flaws are, and I'm not going to defend them because they're there. You know, why would I try and cover up the flaws that are actually there? But I think it's a lot of fun. It's got some great horror, some great gore scenes, and the haunting supernatural aspects, the demonic hellish aspects of the movie are done just to the right point where they don't overcompensate the sci-fi aspect of it. I think it's a good blend. Maybe, I mean, I want to see that other 30 minutes, but also I'm kind of good with how it is. All right, so here we go. This is what they thought of the film.
Another one of those science fiction thrillers where they're marooned way out there in space and there's something not human on board the ship, right there along with them. We've seen this before. We've seen versions of it three times in Alien. But so what if the movie is any good? I'm afraid, though, this one is so badly underwritten that the characters seem to repeat themselves in between the action scenes. But the opening is intriguing. On board a rescue ship sent to find a secret vessel built to warp space and time. Lawrence Fishburne is the captain, and Sam Neill is the scientist who designed the lost spaceship.
Okay, yeah, so, you know, he's obviously going to start off with that, because how can you not? We've seen this concept before, but obviously people like this concept, right? Otherwise, they would not keep making this type of film.
Yeah, we've seen it before. We've seen the space aspect of it. We've seen the table setting of the meeting to discuss the mission. All that's reminiscent. So we get all that. So, but one thing that we do add to this movie, even when we are in the first act and we don't see anything else of the event horizon, is we see the sleep chambers, we see the hints of green, we see a seclusion upon seclusion, where you're really there in a nightmarish era of going into something that can be a little nightmarish. And I think the movie doesn't focus too much on that, but it's just a mere idea that we haven't really seen time and time again. So there are elements, if you're looking for them, to find unique.
In a movie like this, you want at least a few rules so you know in a rough way what they're up against, what can happen, what can't happen. But Event Horizon is all over the map, and I was completely unsatisfied by the behavior of the villain, who knows things he couldn't know and seems to be playing both sides of the game at the same time. I did like the production design. It's a great-looking picture, and I thought the actors did what they could, but the dialogue is very thin.
Well, I'm in a complete agreement with you. Again, this is the classic American movie, or the bad American movie that we're getting made. Action, production design, better than the screenplay. There is basically no screenplay here other than a scientific explanation of the premise.
Yeah, which isn't really...
There are no characters at all.
I was reminded...
You could have the actor... I was thinking this during the picture. I had a lot of time to think about things other than the story, because there wasn't any.
He's so... I don't know. When he gets cheeky about a film, especially... when he starts saying there's no characters, there are characters. And while they may have superficial backstories and side stories that we see come to haunt them, just like in Solaris, they're not bad performances. And I like what Roger said. They do the best what they can with the dialogue. Jason Isaacs, you know, I love the guy. He's in the latest season of White Lotus. And I was like, Jason Isaacs, haven't seen him for a minute since he was like Draco's dad. He really brings that knowledge to the film. And I think that's one of the most important roles in the movie, because Sam Neill, as knowledgeable as he is, he has a secret. And he has ulterior motives that we want to like him, we want to support him, but we know that he has a side quest because his hauntings of his wife on the ship.
I think when it comes to the characters, there is a lot more layers than what a first-time viewing is going to do, because every character, like you said, they all have inner demons or an inner conflict that represent themselves on screen that do become present in a conflict at some point. So now when it comes to, I will say this in contradiction, is when it comes to the Isaac character, when we first hear the voiceover, the recording, and the Latin is spoken, and we have this brilliant scientist played by Neil that nobody discovered that this was a Latin language, and that takes some random guy in space to say, hey, that's Latin. Yeah, that's a trope, that's a cliche, I get it. But there are little flaws on that, but it's to push these characters forward. And at times when we take a summer movie, a sci-fi movie, we're not expecting a masterpiece. Every movie is going to have flaws, and you can have thin dialogue. You can have bad dialogue, but that's not the end game. It's how it's delivered. Is it convincing? So, because if you're a normal ticket payer going into an auditorium, watching a movie, are you really going to, like me, put subtitles on and read the words? No, that's just a backup in case to support if the performances are bad. If it convinces you that this story is believable and real, then it's done its job. And that is a critic's job, to ensure that I am convinced that there is a threat. I am convinced that this is going to take us to a, a crescendo of uncomfortable moments or a stake that I really do care about. And that's what I think Event Horizon really does. But we're being way too analytical on the spoken word here because it's delivered extremely well.
Now that we have technology that we can have a voice on, I think that changes everything, where it's like now we can give our opinions on podcasts, we can give our opinions on Rotten Tomatoes or in blogs and forums. It's just a different kind of appreciation. But I'm going to go back to the points that you've been making for the last, you know, year and a half now on this podcast. These guys are just trying to tell people if it was worth their money. And I think that is the end of the day. I have to go back to that point of view when I defend or attack their critique.
100%. But at the same time, if I were to place, I never saw this in the theater, but on video, I had a blast with it. And if Rotten Tomatoes was available back then, I would say, based on the cult following that it has now, it would have had a positive audience reaction. Now, audiences might not have been ready to buy a ticket to the theater, but they sure as hell were ready to rent it. And that's a good indication that this movie would have done well with proper marketing. And if the critics opened their minds to what audiences really wanted, was it entertaining? That's where it needed to be landed in critics' review. This was entertaining. This was to a point it had enough to keep the story going. But this one is one of those movies. It's horror, it's sci-fi, it's easy to compare to go down that rabbit hole of saying this isn't like that. And that thing is what I liked. So this one should stand on its own of entertainment value. We can go through some B movies like Ghost Ship or Deep Rising, things like that are just kind of cheesy, but their intent is to entertain and to have a good time. This one was meant to be uncomfortable. It was meant to be a gore fest, and the intent was accomplished by our filmmakers. So, and the entertainment value was there. So that's what audiences want to hear, and that's what should have been landed.
I think one of the big things about this movie is that, to me, Event Horizon is an exposure film. So if it was marketed poorly and you didn't go see it in the theater, I'm going to bet that most people that had their first experience of this movie is because someone told them to watch it, or they had them come over and they watched it together, or they lent it to somebody. And that's the thing, right? Like, it's the same way books work in book clubs, where it's like, oh, did you read this book? Oh, have you? Let's go read it in our book club. Let's do this, do that. The difference is that movies are expensive, right? And it's hard to build a legacy for a film off of word of mouth and exposure and sharing a year after it's come out in the theater, where its big opportunity to make money has already come and gone. That's like the double-edged sword of cinema, is that if it doesn't make its money in that first go-around, no one cares about it in the industry, and no one cares about it in the marketing aspect or the critique aspect. But the exposure part of it, where we'll start having screening parties, or I'll lend my 20-year-old DVD to somebody, right? That's how this film gets discovered, and that's how cult movies live on. Essentially, they have to get ignored by critics and audiences in the theater first. So I think that's where it lands. They finished up the conversation with this.
Well, let me give you an example of how thin this movie is. It's obviously inspired by Solaris,
okay,
which is a great Russian film by Andrei Tarkovsky about a space station, right, around a planet that allows them to imagine that they are seeing things that they feel guilty about or sentimental about from their own past lives.
Panic attack.
So that's the whole gimmick. And then you just cross fertilize it with something that attacks them or doesn't attack them. And what you do is you take a great idea, as in Solaris, and you cheapen it down, you dumb it down, and then you wind up with something like Event Horizon.
The whole rhythm is everyone is going to have a panic attack at some point on the
right.
And so you just count the characters down, because then you know the movie's going to be over.
It's like they gave up on the movie before they even like got halfway through the film, you know? But that's typical for them. It really is typical that if they are not convinced or intrigued within the first 20 minutes of the movie, very rarely do we hear them talk about a film that got them back at the end. I think we covered maybe one or two. Fright Night was one of them, I think, for Roger, where it got him like, oh yeah, like I didn't like it at first, but as it was playing and I saw what it was doing, it got me back. And I think Vampires was that for Gene. So like they have their moments where movies come back and get them in the end, but I think we've concluded that if they're not digging it in the first 20 minutes, they're not going to dig the rest of it.
This is one comment that really does bug me, because when it's spoken that you have these characters are going to have panic attacks and then there's going to be one death after another, you can go into any sci-fi slash horror movie, have a group of 10, and know just automatically going in that all of them are not going to hold hands and walk off of the screen happy. Of course, right. Nobody's going to survive. And of course, no, we're not going to have a happy ending. So this is the point where you have to have the inner conflicts. And they even spoke to it. They all have panic attacks. Yes, but it's not panic attacks. They're inner conflicts. They each have an unresolved situation that the ship brings to the present to address. So this one is a religious tie-in that they never address in their review, and it should be relevant here, that there is significance to all these panic attacks, if you will, or these inner demons that do come up. These demons are present when it comes to the likes of hell that arise in this ship. It is a unique idea. It's an intriguing idea, and we shouldn't follow the same formula of comparison of other sci-fi horror movies. This is a combination that tries to do something a little bit different, and it's not recognized. So that's where it really does kind of tick me off a little bit when it comes to the critique, is that they are expecting something fresh and new, but you can take any space movie from 1997 to now. How many different ideas have we gotten that we can do in space with a cast of 10 to 20 to 15 to 5 people? It doesn't really matter. It's what you do with it. And this movie did something with it. It's just they didn't want to recognize it.
We've seen so many different versions of this movie since it came out. I appreciate the fact that it did go hard in the violence. It went for that R. It went for that mature audience. I will always appreciate when a sci-fi film takes it out of the family-friendly realm where it just loves to stay. You know, I love Star Trek and I like Star Wars enough, but yeah, like, make sci-fi dangerous and you've got something special there if done right. And, you know, as a cult film enthusiast, I think this film did it right. It just took a while for it to get appreciated. So, I mean, neither critic liked this film, but with Gene's review, I'm going to go back to like that same old guideline that I follow whenever he gives up on a movie before it gives him the opportunity to like really appreciate it. He's already put the blinders on, and who knows if he's even finished the film sometimes. Sometimes I question whether or not he even finished the screening based on how he breaks down his review and chooses the things to pick on. And like, okay, but you aren't talking about what happened after the fact. That pulls us away from that. So did you even really finish the movie? So for that, I'm giving this guy a D on the review.
I think it's totally fair. And Roger's going to be a hard one on this one because he is a true lover of sci-fi. And I think this is where I'm a little disappointed, is that he doesn't recognize the integration of inner conflicts to religion, to the sci-fi aspect, the symbolic pieces that are present here, from the upside down bodies formating a cross. There is a lot that he missed here. And he is a brilliant guy when it comes to analyzing sci-fi films. But if he gets a taste of something that he doesn't like, or if he doesn't want gore in a sci-fi film, this movie is dead on arrival. And I think that's what we saw here with Roger. And I have to say, this is one of my more disappointing ones in comparison to The Ghost in the Darkness, that he put emotion into it versus an actual critic review. So to me, I'm going to give him 1.5 stars.
And when we give reviews like this for the critics, it's not saying this is a 4-star movie at all. It just, to me, I think it reflects the fact that there is so much more to dissect in a film like this than just the broad strokes that they've painted onto their critique. It's like a lazy critique, which is going to be interesting because when we get into next week's episode, they went on forever about it. We'll get to that in a minute. So yeah, I think it is interesting when they don't appreciate a film, they kind of stop themselves short and allow them time to speak more about a film they actually did like later on. Where I think the interesting conversation is dissecting a film that they did not like as much. To me, that's more of an interesting conversation, even though that's not the intent of the show. That's what I wish they would do more often.
100%. And I think when we do this show between last season and this season, I think we've had more broad conversations on the films that they didn't like, because it is absolutely intriguing based on their analysis of why they didn't like it compared to another one. And we're going to see that more and more and more, and it's becoming more and more deep. And with me, aggravating the more deeper we get into these guys.
So next week, it is my turn to bring a movie to the show. I am bringing 1989's Casualties of War, directed by Brian De Palma, starring Sean Penn, Michael J. Fox, John C. Reilly, John Leguizamo. Pretty great cast early in their careers, right? And I'm bringing this for a very specific reason. I'll get into it more in that episode, but I revisit this movie every few years because it is one of the De Palma films I struggle the most with. But each time I revisit it, I get a little more out of it. So I wanted to use this podcast as an opportunity to not only revisit it for myself, but hear what these guys thought about it, because they were very critical about De Palma in some instances and very favorable in others. So I was curious to see where this fell on their radar, because it's on the lower tier for me. I just want to see if there's any consistency there. So that'll be a fun episode. Tune in next week.
Can't wait for that. So haven't seen it in probably a decade. So this is going to be a good conversation.
Please like, review, give us 5 stars on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Make sure that you subscribe to our YouTube channel. Give us a review there. Share it with your friends. And if you've got any suggestions for films that you want us to cover, let us know. We've got a list, but we'll always make room for listener requests. We haven't done a whole lot of those this new season. We've been really tackling the movies that we hadn't seen, and now we've pulled out of that to go back to like familiar things. It's time to get some more listener and viewer requests in. So send them our way. And with that, you can always find me, Antonio, at my website, thecultworthy.com. Justin, you can be found at
themoviewire.com.
Thank you for visiting us, and we'll see you next week.
See you next week.